The Centersteer Podcast, a Land Rover podcast by Land Rover owners. Welcome to the 16th edition of the Centersteer Podcast. It is July 20th, 2014. I'm your host, John Kostich, talking to you from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, at least near it. I lately been like to talk about the weather, and then the weather today is slightly overcast. It is relatively cool for July here in Pittsburgh. It's supposed to be hazy, hot, and humid, dripping sweat as soon as you walk outside, but thankfully it's not been that way.
We've been enjoying a nice polar vortex event this past week.
That's what they were calling it. The little odd fact about it that I don't think that I had forgotten about from wintertime, which is different. You know, an overcast day in winter is different than an overcast day in summer. What I've noticed about an overcast day in summer is you forget what time it is. Because in the wintertime, you're inside and there's other things going on. You're more likely to be inside. And there's clocks and things to look at. When it's summer and you're outside because it's nice and it's overcast, you have no sense of time. I just find that very fascinating.
For those of us who tell time by looking at the position of the sun in the sky, yes, that is correct.
Exactly, right. I don't wear a watch. I haven't worn a watch in years. I hate watches.
Also makes navigation difficult.
Yes, absolutely. Just a little interesting fact. And as you heard, dear listeners, sitting across from me at the table is...
I'm Harold.
Anything you want to add?
Not today.
Oh, that's true. We've got conversation coming. He's going to talk a lot.
You'll hear from me enough.
And sitting across from us on Skype...
I'm Morgan from Vermont, and, you know, up here we've had the opposite. We've got a nice, beautiful, sunny day. It's 81 degrees, so, yeah, that's the weather report from Vermont.
Good. That's always good to have a weather report from Vermont. We have been chasing some technical issues on our audio, so hopefully this change we've made for this edition will sound much better and be a little easier for me to get produced, so we will certainly find out. I have purchased another bit of hardware to make things better for us on the recording end, which shouldn't affect the listeners, except to say that it's easier to record on our end. So we are certainly interested in your feedback on quality. I've been trying to make the audio quality much better over the months and the years we've been doing this. That's almost 2 years now. And yeah, comment away. If you know how to make the audio better, let me know. This is much more difficult than I ever anticipated. The audio, making good audio quality podcasts is much more difficult than I had originally intended.
And, of course, we are still looking for feedback on content.
Absolutely.
Things you like, things you want to hear more of, things you want to hear less of, that's fine, too.
That's a good point. Yeah, since we've been doing this, from the original intent of the podcast, we've kind of kept to it. But we've also changed a little bit and modified and rolled, which is fine.
Like Land Rovers themselves, we're evolving.
Absolutely, yes. We didn't know what we were doing and probably still don't, but it has been evolving. So, yes, comments are welcome. So we will start with the news. We usually start with sales. I haven't seen any sales figures, and, you know, we can skip it for this year, but that's fine. For this month.
We can assume they're still selling.
But I have a little interesting bit of JLR news. This has actually nothing to do with JLR itself. I just noticed my first Pennsylvania license plate, or number plate if you're in the UK, that begins with JLR. So Pennsylvania has moved. They skipped the I's. There's no I. Our number plates, you know, are sequential, especially in Pennsylvania. Each state has their own style of plates. And Pennsylvania, I'd say about 8 to 10 years ago, switched over to three letters followed by four numbers. And so ABC, 1, 2, 3, 4, it would be a standard PA license plate. And they're now up to JLR 0008 was the number one, was the one I saw.
I suspect you also won't see the letter O.
You won't see the letter O. You won't see the letter I. They skipped I. They went straight to
H. I suspect
H-I.
Z might be off the list as well.
No, Z...
They can be confused with the number 2. That's why I say that.
Probably. And Ys are all trucks.
Right.
In Pennsylvania. So just a little interesting.
Those are the same letters you will not see in a VIN as well, by the way.
Makes sense. Because of the...
confusion for numerals.
Right. So. But we do have actual news, and actually it probably is related. In the UK, the vehicle tax disc is going away, effective October 1st, 2014, or I'll translate for our UK listeners, 1 October 2014. The paper tax disc will no longer need to be displayed on a vehicle windscreen. This is direct from the UK's government's website. I did a little research. I do not know why, and unfortunately, one of our UK participants could not join us today to hopefully enlighten us.
Will the disc still be issued to be carried in the vehicle, some sort of proof that you would provide?
That was not clear to me. It just sounds like, I think, it sounds like it's, the information they had on there, and this is on the government news, vehicle tax changes is all of the site is, and all I got was what this, you know, so there's what this means to you. To drive or keep a vehicle on the road, you'll still need to get vehicle tax, and DLVA will still send you a renewal reminder when your vehicle tax is due to expire. This applies to all types of vehicles, including those that are exempt from payment of vehicle tax. So it sounds like you'll get a receipt of some sort, but right. Doesn't sound like you'll put that on your windscreen.
Okay. You still have to pay, obviously, and whether you have to carry that proof or not that you have paid is not clear.
Right. I suspect it's all probably electronic now, and I'm sure when they pull up your registration number plate in the UK, I'm sure that they go, oh, tax paid, yes, no.
As it is here, they have expiration information available right. On board the police cruiser.
Well, actually, in PA, I think in next year, we're getting rid of our that sticker that we put on the number plate, the license plate. That's going away.
Really?
Yes. You're going to pay, which...
So no more four-corner bingo.
No more four-corner bingo, which is actually... Did you have that, Morgan, in Vermont? Do you have that little sticker that you put on the license plate?
Yeah, we do. We actually have one designated spot on the plate that you're supposed to put it. So people are not supposed to put it in different corners, but they do. They start to spread them out, and technically they can complain. But
same thing.
We actually switched to putting the sticker only on the rear plate. We actually require front and rear plates, unlike some states, but you only have to put the sticker on the rear plate to save them, you know.
Fairly common,
half
actually.
The sticker printing cost.
Many states most states actually have a front and rear, and some of those are now going to the sticker only on the rear, which begs the question, why have one in the front? But nonetheless, we have the same problem. We have the one designated spot. It's actually stamped into the plate. It's the only corner with a depression, and
top,
yet people still spread the stickers around. It's most annoying.
Yep, top left is the official location for a Commonwealth of Pennsylvania license plate.
And ours is bottom right. We have a big T. It's basically the Department of Transportation logo, so that you're supposed to cover that up. If they see the T, that means that there's something wrong. But, yeah.
Oh, interesting. And Pennsylvania is one of those states that does not have a front license plate.
Yep.
And hasn't for decades.
I don't think
decades.
Did they ever have one?
As I recall, I was told once that they were discontinued during World War II to save on metal.
Which makes a lot of sense.
Yep. Around here, we're rural enough that they still, you know, half the time they're catching you from the front, so they want to be able to read your plate.
I'm surprised PA hasn't put it back in, because for those very reasons that they want to, you know, they're tracking you coming and going.
What amazes me is, given that a majority of the states require a front plate, that even the American automakers seem to design the front license plate bracket as an afterthought.
Oh, yes, definitely.
Yeah, you're right, they do. That's right. Yeah, they have that stupid thing you clamp on.
As such, vehicles always look better without a front plate.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I would suspect that it's because they get better gas mileage, and then since that's some sort of specific requirement they have to put on based on the state, they can probably say this meets federal requirements. We get, even if it's 0.001% better gas mileage without it, then slap it on, and okay, that's life.
Aerodynamically speaking, you might be correct. However, they could design the mount into the bumper in such a way that it would not impact the aerodynamics. And actually, this predates anyone's concern over mileage. Even back in the gas-guzzling 60s and 70s, the car still looked more ugly with a front plate.
Yep, definitely. And briefly back to the UK tax status, you can actually look those up for any vehicle just online on their website. Because I was able to look up my series truck and see that it was last tax was last paid on it in like 2003 before I imported it.
And you know, in the show notes, we'll have a link to the story from the UK government's website, and there is a link there also for checking the tax status of any vehicle online. This can also be used for rental vehicles.
It can also be used to determine date of first registration of a vehicle in the UK, which can be useful for topics which we will soon be discussing.
Next on the news, the spied in two different countries is the Land Rover Discovery Sport. And this is courtesy of carscoops.com. And the nice thing about this specific article, we've talked about this before, so the Discovery Sport, but this article confirms what we've been talking about for a number of months, is that the Discovery Sport will replace the Freelander as the name, and it will also be based off of the Range Rover Evoque frame. And so so that was some bit of news that seems to be, at least based on the article as I read it, that seems to be the case. There was a...
As we had speculated.
Yes. There was a prototype in Belgium and seen, and also one in London seen. And this is within the past couple weeks that they saw this article.
Love the little porthole windows in the spy shot you just had on your screen there, John.
Oh, that's... they put that camouflage on there.
I know, but they left a little porthole.
They did.
That's
so
cool.
In the back corner there, yeah. They put that weird...
I see aftermarket panels coming that create that look, but that's just me.
Yeah, then it looks like one of those weird vans you don't want to get into.
Creepy vans?
Yeah, there's other words for those.
Maybe that's why I want to leave that.
Yeah. But I'm sure the actual vehicle would not look like that. It's the camo they put on there. Yes, which is kind of interesting. So that's coming. Not sure yet when. Exactly. I suspect it's 2015 from the other things we've heard in the past. But the point of this is new Freelander replacement coming called the Disco Sport, and it is based off of an Evoque. So probably about that size is pretty much, which, and we'll talk about this a little later, but we were at the Pittsburgh Vintage Grand Prix, and they had an Evoque, and I actually sat in one, and it was pretty nice. I could get in with my hat on, which I thought was impressive.
But yes, because you wear a hat all the time. This is useful.
I wear a hat sometimes when it's raining.
Occasions when you do wear a hat, you'll be able to get in without hitting it. That's
yes.
a good thing.
Yes. I could get in much easier in the Disco 4. That was impressive. There's a lot of hat height in the Disco 4.
Not surprising at all.
Yes. Next is British Petroleum, or as they're probably known as BP now, says we have 53.3 years of oil left. Now, this is from autoblog.com, and of course, we'll have this link in the show notes. But the point of this is that as a planet, and the United States in particular, has 44.2 billion barrels in reserve. And this actually is a 26% increase from previous estimates. And the reason that one of the reasons why it seems like there's a long time, I think there's a long time left of oil, is they're finding more and more oil in other places. And this, it's not clear in the article, but I take it that they're including not only oil as we know it, standard petroleum that we put in our cars, but also natural gas. And they're finding lots and lots of natural gas here in the United States in these Marcellus Shale and other shale areas that are in various parts of the United States. There's one in Texas, West Texas. There's one in the Rocky Mountains. And, of course, here underneath Pennsylvania, there's a huge one. That's the Marcellus Shale one is underneath Pennsylvania.
Actually, I'm inclined to believe that 53 years does not include natural gas because I've heard much larger numbers than that referring to our natural gas reserves.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah.
But I could be wrong. I'm no petroleum expert.
And neither am I. Yeah, my only concern, and the article states this too, and I do agree with it, is while we may have 53 years, which would make me almost 100 years old, if that in fact is the case, we just don't want this to restrict. I don't want to see it restrict any of our efficiency gains that we're pushing towards. I think that's a smart thing to continue to do, and even switch over to other sources of power.
Well, I wouldn't think that this would cause us to slack off on that, because even though it's slightly more than we thought we had, it's still only 50 years.
Yeah, we've only been drilling oil in the U.S. since, like, the 1900s, basically.
The late
I think 1896 was like the first commercial oil well.
Right, and at
in
that
the
point,
United
we
States.
Were, at that point, we were throwing the gasoline away because it was a useless waste product.
And guess where? This is when I got to bring up local history. Well, you know, Pennsylvania, southwestern, is actually western PA. It was actually northwestern Pennsylvania. That's where oil, quote unquote, and gasoline all started.
And hence the name of the town, Oil City.
Oil City, exactly. That's and
Franklin, just up the road from them.
Penn's Oil came right out of Pennsylvania Oil.
Quaker State.
And Quaker State. So, yeah, it's all PA related. So, yeah.
That said, I will advise people to never put Penn's Oil in their car, but don't get me in trouble with them. But
you just did.
Oh, well.
All right. Why?
Well, they will, of course, argue that. But I've seen I've been inside many of an engine that has used Penn's Oil exclusively for 30,000 miles. And it's incredible the amount of buildup you get inside that engine.
So you've heard it here.
It's controversial. That controversy has been around for 30 years or more. I'm just confirming that I believe on the one side of it. Mind you, it's only my professional opinion, so do not construe that as reflective of the official opinions of the Center Steer podcast.
We have an official opinion? This is the big topic for this podcast. Who knows how long it'll take us to talk about. I will do a little setup, and then we'll turn it over to our special correspondent.
Fun is an interesting word to describe this topic, by the way.
So this week in the United States of America, the Department of Homeland Security, Customs, Border, and Protection knocked on the doors of 40 owners of Land Rover, quote-unquote, Defenders, and seized said vehicles. This is a fallout from a gentleman in North Carolina who has been arrested and charged with, I think, illegal importation, I suspect, and Harold will clarify that in just a moment. And these were apparently vehicles were seized as evidence in that case. So that's the kind of like little quick background. There was a lot of discussion when this happened, I think, on Thursday. I think Thursday morning's when it blew up. And so Harold has done a lot of research and has been reading pages and pages and pages and pages of posts. And I think we'll give us a little summary and see what happens.
Okay. So unfortunately, my introduction will contradict much of what you just said, unfortunately.
Well, that's actually good because that was the stuff that I saw that I picked up when I read the articles, and I wasn't reading a lot of things in particular.
Do you want me to start where I was going to start, or do you want me to sort of build on what you just said?
Start where you want to start.
Okay. Well, it's certainly been an interesting week in Land Rover land, but there is a big story which has been blossoming on the internet. One of the forum sites known as DefenderSource.com broke this story at approximately 8 a.m. on Tuesday, July 15th. A gentleman started a thread called Homeland Security Took My 110. Apparently at about 6:45 a.m., agents knocked on his door with a federal arrest warrant to seize his truck. Of course, this prompted a quick posting on this site. A lot of response started out being very panicked, a lot of shock. Then people started saying, yes, just happened to me as well. About a half a dozen or more people chimed in that they've lost their trucks. And the forum has exploded since then, and people have been chiming in right and left with their opinions and accusations and conspiracy theories, finger pointing, name calling, all sorts of things, what have you. As of the end of day, the following day, Wednesday the 16th, page number 24. Of this thread, post number 473. I will read this post to you. It is most interesting. It is from a gentleman by the name of Will Hedrick. And he says, okay, gentlemen, I hope I don't regret doing this, but I've undertaken the task of representing a fellow member and neighbor whose 110 was seized yesterday. I'm doing so pro bono, i.e. at no charge, and I'm willing to extend the same courtesy to the other members who might also have been affected. In full disclosure, I'm not currently in private practice, but I am a licensed North Carolina attorney employed with the state of North Carolina and a member of the United States District Court of the Eastern District of North Carolina. I have today been in contact with the Customs and Border Patrol agent in charge of the seizures and with the U.S. attorney who is handling the case. Per those conversations, I have assured them both that I will be not sharing their contact information, so please do not ask. I'm willing to speak with you individually about your vehicles. If you would like to speak with me, I request that you email me your particulars and then allow me to return your calls. Otherwise, this will all get disorderly very quickly. Anyway, it goes on. There's a few more things to say. Basically, he's offering to help anyone who's had their truck taken. There are apparently 40 trucks on this particular warrant. I have seen a copy of the warrant. We will get into that in a bit. The common thread with all of this is that these are all vehicles which were imported by one particular importer, and it's related to a story that we covered here last year. There was a search and seizure being executed upon a particular individual in North Carolina. He's a chiropractor by day, but does importations of Land Rovers and works on them, et cetera, by night. He's associated with a used car dealer in Wilmington, North Carolina. And when they executed this search warrant last year, they seized all of the records related to approximately 110 trucks that they were suspicious of. They had acquired the files, the paperwork, et cetera, and proceeded to work upon them. This has resulted in this search warrant for 40 vehicles, not the 160 that was reported in one place or the 61 that was reported in another place, but 40 vehicles.
Did he do this himself? Is he the guy that brought them in and then the used car shop is the one that worked on them? Or did he do this work or did he have his like a shop?
Well, tell you what, let me shift over to my other page here. I have a copy of the federal complaint which was filed, and it gives some of the background of that information. Of course, this is a federal complaint filed in United States District Court of Eastern North Carolina. The United States of America is the plaintiff, and a list of 40 trucks listed individually by VIN number, collectively referred to as the defendant. So yes, apparently a manufactured item can be a defendant in a legal case. This is a civil action.
Well, corporations are people, so.
Well, yeah, apparently. Apparently, trucks are too. Anyway, in the background information of this, beyond all the legalese of the complaint, Attachment A is a report from the federal special agent who did the investigation in this. In his background information, he's listing Patterson Auto Sales is the dealer in question, and it lists the names of the president and secretary of the corporation. But in their filing with the Secretary of State in North Carolina, this gentleman, whose name is Aaron Richardet, I think I'm pronouncing his name correctly, we'll refer to him as Doc Aaron. This Doc Aaron was listed as a sales agent for this dealer. Now, I do know from poking around the internet for the past several years that Aaron was representing himself also as Rovers Down East, I believe, at one point, and GB4x4 at another point. I suspect he was processing his sales transactions through Patterson Auto Sales as the licensed dealer. But in all of the importation filings with Customs, Aaron Richardet was listed on the importation as himself and not through the name of the business. I think that answers your question in more detail than you wanted.
I was curious of who actually did the work on the trucks when they were brought in. He didn't do that.
I believe it was Aaron and people working for him under the blanket of the business entities that he had. So, it's not clear about that in these documents.
So it's sounding less and less like a proper shop that you would go to, and there's a secretary, and then there's 16 guys in the back, and
one would
on
think
stuff.
Not.
Yeah. Okay.
Although I was never there, But it seems a bit more like a spare time type business. But he was running all of his sales transactions through this dealer, which he was officially listed as a salesman for the dealership. And I think that's how he kind of took care of his paperwork.
Right.
Again, that's not an issue here. And
right,
actually,
that's just a background in the warrant.
From what I understand, Doc Aaron is not subject to any criminal prosecution at this point. This is strictly an action related to importation paperwork. It's a civil process.
Well, wasn't he arrested, though?
I do not believe he was. Okay. And in fact, I can kind of get into that a little bit here.
Well, then I apologize.
Let me back up a little bit to October of 2012, which is apparently where this all started. Apparently, there were two vehicles that were presented to Customs for import with paperwork that was filled out by Doc Aaron. Let me see if I can get there in my...
Will this connect in with the one that was crushed a couple months ago?
I do not know about that particular vehicle, but it could be, because the two vehicles which he presented, basically I can't quite find the details I'm looking for, but one was a... There's just so much to look at, and I apologize here.
Well, that's fine. So where we're at is that it sounds like he was not arrested, but the trucks are still being seized because they are allegedly illegally imported, possibly by this gentleman.
Right, and I will get to that in a little bit here. Basically, what happened was these two vehicles, they were both 110s. They both had galvanized frames. They both had disc brake rear axles, which are not
current
of the correct time period.
Right.
It was enough that Customs became a little bit suspicious of it, so they submitted to they sent it to DOT, who then referred it to Land Rover. Land Rover provided more information. The one 110 was, reasonably close to what it said it was, except that it was galvanized and it had a TD5 in it, which was a vintage 2006 engine. Land Rover has never manufactured a galvanized frame for any of their Defenders. That's an aftermarket thing. So the VIN stamping on the frame was not done correctly. It was enough that they were somewhat suspicious of the age of the vehicle. The other vehicle, the VIN was assigned to a left-hand drive 90, but the truck was a right-hand drive 110. And the VIN plate was not correctly attached to the brake booster on the bulkhead, not using the correct rivets. It kind of looked like the stampings were off a little bit. So that one raised more red flags than you could possibly imagine, as it should. These two events caused the investigators to focus an investigation upon the vehicle's imported by Richardet and sold through Patterson Auto Sales. They queried, I believe they looked at customs records for anything that was processed by him. They, at that point, got their federal warrant. Looks like on March 25th of 2013, they executed the federal search warrant at Patterson Auto Sales for records related to importation of these vehicles. Upon reviewing the records, each separate vehicle file contained to whom the vehicle was sold to, the HS7, which is the DOT declaration form, the EPA 3520, which is the EPA compliance form, et cetera, other documents. Looking at the numbers on that, and then it looked like there were some irregularities there. They then went to Land Rover and submitted 110 VIN numbers for their take on when they were built. Land Rover came back with, looks like, 51 vehicles that were a little bit off, 40 of which were selected for this particular warrant. And I'm actually looking at that list. I have it here attached as Table 1.
And we'll have a link to this in the show notes?
I believe we can have a link to that in the show notes. John,
it's a public document.
It is. Actually, interestingly enough, when this all broke loose on Tuesday morning, this case was still sealed by the United States District Court. And since then, it has become unsealed. So, in fact, this is a matter of public record. I am legally entitled to be looking at this, and I am legally entitled to be telling you about it right now. So, yeah, I think we can probably make that available. The interesting thing to note here is that while there are some vehicles here which are showing as 6, 9, or 11 years old, the overwhelming majority of them show up as 24 years old. And if you look at, you parse out the actual dates on everything, they were probably a couple months shy of the 25-year exemption period when they entered, which is very interesting to me.
Does that include the 40 that were actually seized? Or were the ones that were not seized, or in those ones that you're talking about that were close to the limit?
Well, in this list of 51 from which the 40 were selected, I said the overwhelming majority of them were just shy of 25 years.
Okay,
so
I see.
From that, there really aren't enough that are apparently flagrant that I think the majority of the ones on the 40 are also close as well.
But let's take a step back. What does that – I don't understand. I'd like a better understanding of the VIN numbers that are there, and you're saying they're close to the limit.
Mm-hmm.
Now, is that the VIN number that was on the vehicle when it was found here in the U.S.?
Well, at this point, these are the VIN numbers that were entered on the customs entry forms when the vehicle was brought in.
So we don't even know if those are the actual ages of the vehicles.
Well, based on the numbers, like I said, the VIN numbers here are pulled from the customs entry forms. The age that they're giving us here on this table, and this, mind you, this is a spreadsheet that was collated by the DHS special investigator with help from Land Rover. The age and the date of manufacture is something they're getting from Land Rover themselves. So the implication here is that the government expects us to take that number as being the age of the vehicle.
Right, which makes sense.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah,
normally.
Sense. So vehicle comes in, it is, and Land Rover has confirmed that the VIN number that's on, that was provided to them, says it was, you know, a 20-year-old truck, a 25-year-old truck, a 30-year-old truck. Those ones were seized. They picked some of those to seize them.
Yes.
And they're probably going to now go ahead and confirm that the VIN number that was on the form matches the one that's on the truck in various places, because don't they, I don't recall when they started stamping it in multiple places, but they'll confirm that first, that the VIN number that was on the form matches what's on the truck.
They will verify that, yes,
right,
absolutely.
That's the thing to do. And
they will be carefully looking for authenticity.
That was my point. And then they're going to start making sure that VIN number is the right one that should have been on that chassis truck.
Right.
Because it's very possible, because what's being alleged here is that the vehicle that came in has the wrong VIN number on it. It's probably a 10-year-old truck or a 15-year-old truck, and it has a 25-year-old VIN.
I think actually there's far less of that than what was originally speculated.
Okay.
There were a lot of theories.
But that's the main point, though. That's the crux of this is that there are that's what kind of the definition of an illegal truck would be.
Not necessarily.
Okay.
I think, like I said, that there's been a lot of speculation in a lot of areas, and there are some vehicles that clearly there is a discrepancy, like I'm looking at here that says there's one here that was declared as a 1983. However, per Land Rover, it says here, production date of March 21, 1986, but 2006 or newer. And I think what they're looking at there is this might be a case where someone's got a galvanized chassis on it and a TD5 in it, and they're going to say, they're going to look at that as being the newest part on the vehicle, and they're going to say parts of it are that age, at which point it doesn't qualify. But there's also a discrepancy here between 1983 and 1986. So this particular vehicle is going to be a problem. However, there are a number of vehicles that may be authentic. The numbers may be right. They may have good provenance. They may not be stolen, but they're a couple months shy on the paperwork. And one of the things they said in here was that it seems as though, in many cases, that when the entry paperwork was filled out, it was actually declared with production dates on it that would have been less than 25 years, but customs let it through anyway. Meaning things that are maybe 24 years, 7 months, something like that. It was declared correctly. The paperwork was all in order, but customs let it through anyway, and now all of a sudden they're coming and getting the trucks.
Understandable. I understand that part. Okay.
And that actually seems to be the majority of what we're looking at here, is things that fell short of the 25 years. They let them through anyway, and now they're
kind of going
allegedly
back
changed their mind.
Or at least that gives them something further to investigate.
Right. And
yes.
kind of like having
your registration sticker not on the license plate. There's a reason to pull you over.
Right. It looks like it kind of looks like a fishing expedition, in the sense that they're just pulling everything in to take a good look at it.
So is it possible, or a question that's been forming as I hear what you're saying, how many for a 25-year-old vehicle, which would put us in, what, 1987? Wait, what's 14?
We'd be looking at 1989
now. How many places was the VIN stamped on a 1989 vehicle?
On a Defender-type vehicle, the VIN would have been in 2 places.
The chassis?
It would have been on the chassis, on the right-hand frame rail, right above right adjacent to where the bumper bolts to it.
Okay, and?
And there, it will be on an aluminum plate that lists Land Rover, or whatever the corporate entity name, the Rover Group Limited or whatever.
Right behind the windscreen.
It would have been below the windscreen. On a Defender, it will be riveted to the pedal tower where the brake booster mounts to it.
Okay. All right. So there's 2 places.
There are 2 places, but and one of the things they're looking at for authenticity of those numbers is the size of the stamping of the numerals, and the fact that there will either be an asterisk or the British Leyland Hurricane of Quality logo, they call it, a little icon representing that Leyland swirl design.
Right.
Either that or an asterisk will precede and follow the numerals in the stamping of the VIN.
Okay, so the one example you said there that had a 83 VIN and an 1986 VIN, is it possible that they're finding a VIN number, the vehicle in question may have 2 different VINs? Then one would be the chassis one is an 83, and the one on the pedal tower is an 86.
All I can tell you is there is a discrepancy with that vehicle. Exact details, I do not know.
I understand. I'm just trying to figure out how this is actually legitimately playing out. I'm trying to envision it, because it seems simple enough to say the vehicle, is the vehicle more than 25 years old? Yay or nay? That's, at least in the United States, for those who maybe are not familiar, we have 2 exemption periods. One's 18 years for safety.
21 years for emissions, 25
for emissions,
for safety.
And 25 for safety. So that has to be, if it's under that, it needs to meet the criteria for the year that it was produced, and usually entails a lot of money
It's very expensive, very complicated to make it comply if it doesn't.
So therefore, these vehicles that are at the exemption limit, 25 is the number we always throw out because that's the larger of the two. So if you're at that limit, you can bring the vehicle in without having to make any changes to the vehicle and to meet any requirements.
Basically, if it's over the certain age, it is exempt from meeting the requirements. There's actually a couple of issues here, one of which is the fact that it appears as though there are some situations, actually perhaps a large number of situations, where the vehicle is, in fact,
compliant, authorized?
One situation appears where, in fact, quite a number of the vehicles here might be legitimately purchased and correct as far as identity. Their VINs are correct and legitimate for the age of the vehicle. However, they were just a little bit too young, maybe a few months short of being old enough to be eligible for the exemption. However, the paperwork was filled out anyway. It was perhaps honestly filled out with the correct information, and customs let them through anyway. And perhaps that goes to a particular customs employee that wasn't maybe being careful enough.
Okay, so that's one issue.
Another issue, and this has been raised by some people involved in this and quite a bit of discussing of this on the Defender Source forum, and that is that Land Rover is actually in error in some of the information that they supplied to the government related to verifying these VIN numbers, that some of the numbers they kicked back for production dates are, in fact, incorrect.
Gasp. Someone actually had wrong information.
Yeah, well, I mean, I have no problem with that if they fix the error, and it does happen.
Yeah.
However, you know, it appears that the government has taken Land Rover's information for gospel and acted upon it swiftly and strongly, perhaps too strongly, I don't know. I did actually speak with Will Hedrick on Friday afternoon related to this, and he had just been on the phone with Land Rover North America's corporate counsel, had a lengthy conversation with them, which he has also posted on the Defender Source forum. In response to things that they discussed, Land Rover has actually promptly prepared and updated a sheet of information related to these VINs that they have forwarded to the U.S. attorney and to the investigator from DHS. Will Hedrick, attorney for the defendants, has not seen this document yet, but he anticipates he will be seeing it in the next few days. So hopefully we'll have updated information and perhaps some of these errors will have been addressed.
Okay, so what we're hearing then has little to do possibly with coming in through the specific North Carolina importer.
It's entirely possible that you are correct, that it has little to do with this guy, but it's just that there were some very wrong things that he was associated with a while back that has caused Customs to look very carefully at the stuff he brought in.
Interesting.
A broader issue here is that I'm discovering through some conversations that part of the problem is there's inconsistency in terms of how Customs is processing the imports, and that it tends to vary from port to port and from employee to employee as far as how they interpret the rules and how they enforce them and how they inspect to determine compliance.
How's Baltimore? Having imported a vehicle through Baltimore, through the port of Baltimore.
Yeah, well, you've imported some. I've imported one as well.
Right.
Yeah, it's one of the reasons why I'm watching very carefully the outcome of this case. It would appear that things are a tad lax at Wilmington. From what I understand, Wilmington is a container only port. It is not service roll on roll off, which is where a vehicle is driven directly onto what amounts to a humongous ferry.
Right, a ro-ro boat.
Yeah, it's called ro-ro for short. Roll on roll off. You drive them on, the ship comes across, and you drive them off. From what I understand, the ro-ro process is different in terms of how customs handles it, and that, from what I gather, tends to be a little more carefully done and has fewer problems, although that's perhaps speculation on my part.
Well, the fact that the vehicle is supposed to be able to be moved
right.
on its own power, so
right.
that might make it a little sense, less chance that you're trying to bring something in a container that, and you're slipping, you're putting a bunch of stuff in a container, and they can't really see what's in there and
right.
check it as easily.
Containers have been sort of haphazardly inspected. Maybe the better word is randomly inspected in the past. But in the last few years, anything related to Land Rovers and Defenders especially has been flagged for extra scrutiny.
Right.
Now it's fairly standard if you're bringing in a container full of Defenders or Defender parts that that container will be pulled. It will be spread out across a warehouse and inspected piece by piece very carefully.
Right.
You will pay hundreds of dollars in extra storage to have this done. And from what I understand, that was done in this case on maybe not every time, but fairly frequently that Doc Aaron's shipments were spread out like this, and yet they still let stuff through.
Well, there probably was legitimate stuff to let through.
Oh, so. I'm sure, and that's fine. I think legitimate stuff should be let through without hassle. But it starts to look like maybe some of the process that Customs uses is flawed.
Gasp. There might actually be an error in processing. I'm just making a joke. It's extremely.
Heaven forbid our government should screw up.
Right, and it's extremely. Well, I mean, I pay good money for hopefully good government, and sometimes, and you certainly don't want to have bad government, and this is potentially a bad government issue. In addition to the fact that it's very unfortunate for the folks that own these vehicles that were seized, and they probably legitimately thought they were actually, properly imported vehicles. Why should they think anything different?
In many cases, these vehicles have already changed hands two or three times, and the people bought them have no clue of the train of handling that they've gone through.
Sure,
just
the
to
second,
get to
third
where
owner.
They,
yeah. It's registered in state X, and so therefore it should be okay.
Well, and that's the thing with this particular case is that the people who bought these trucks, even the original purchasers, if you will, the original American purchasers, they were all purchased from a used car dealer in North Carolina, and they all had clear North Carolina title on them. They were not anything that they were thinking there was any hassle with, and they figured if it's in the country and it's got a North Carolina title, that it must be free and clear and legal. I don't think anyone, but I think a majority of these purchasers failed to think about or be aware of the fact that customs can come back anytime on these things if they think there's a problem.
Right. Yeah. Well, which is, and I'm sure that's in the fine print, probably some of the 1,600 pages of documents that you sign when you do this. But yeah, it certainly is the government's right to take a look at this stuff and come and take and review it. It's very unfortunate for those involved losing use of their vehicle. And so what's the process? Is there a process that they potentially could get their vehicle back, or did you do any research or checking on that? Is there going to be a hearing that they go to?
Well, there
or is able to go to.
There is an appeal process. Unfortunately, the government's position is this is contraband, and they're entitled to seize it and do what they will with it at this point. They can either return it or destroy it at their choice, basically. Although I'm not sure exactly of the legal
basis. There's going to be some due process, though.
Well, there is due process in the sense that there is an appeal period, and that is what we're dealing with right now. Will Hedrick is processing that for many of the people. He is chasing this down and attempting to get vehicles back.
Right.
If at all possible to get them back. What concerns me a little bit is that in the complaint, which was filed in this past April, actually, which we requested the arrest warrant for these trucks, it claims that the defendants were all notified and given an opportunity to appear and or comment about this stuff, and I don't know that that happened.
But if the defendants are the trucks, how do the trucks appear?
Well, yeah, I think exactly. That's the interesting part here is that the defendant is not a person. It's an object. But,
yeah.
I mean, I would have to assume that they would send the defendant, send the truck, a letter at its last known registered address, meaning, sending the owner of the truck a letter saying, hey, we got a problem. You need to answer some questions. And I don't know that that happened with any one of these 40.
Which would hopefully come out in the appeal process if they didn't have the opportunity to, respond in the beginning.
Yeah, I think the big objection is that the government just showed up and took their stuff.
Right. Which, and understandably, that's what you're going to hear, and that's the first thing, if that's your first interaction with this, it's going to be upsetting.
Well, which, mind you, in on the other side of the coin, looking at it from the police power side of things, you might say. Normally, you know, the constitutional amendments related to searches and seizures tend not to apply to vehicles because vehicles are by their very nature mobile. And the idea is they give people notice that they're coming for their truck. Those trucks are going to disappear. I mean, not to say that it's right for them to do right. what they did, but right. I think that's yeah. their side of how they're looking at it.
I suspect, and right, sure. But there's a lot. There's also enough law around that, that to take care and handle that process. And I'm sure there's some, you know, notification process may have not been properly followed.
I suspect that. I mean, there are those that feel that you know, the whole homeland security aspect of the government is sort of stepping up their powers to the point of being a little bit overreaching. The fact that Customs is part of Homeland Security, and they mention that Homeland Security name, and suddenly they can do what they want. And I'm not saying I agree with that. I'm just saying there are many that feel that way.
That's just the overarching agency that handles Customs. Customs used to be under Treasury, I think, before 9/11.
Right, and I think the fact that they're located under the Department of Homeland Security is about as relevant as saying the Secret Service is part of the Department of Treasury. It's
actually not.
It was at one time.
It was. It is now part of the Department of Homeland Security.
Right. But the point being is
yes.
that
it's meaningless.
Agencies are located in departments just for administrative purposes.
For many reasons, yes, you're right.
So, I mean, it's a little bit of an overstatement to say Homeland Security came and got my truck. It was a customs action.
It makes for a good headline, though.
Sure, it does.
And it'll get your attention.
It apparently did attract attention of many, many, many people.
As it should. So, okay, so trucks have been seized. We have some reasonings as to why. It's possibly because of some incorrect information, possibly because the VINs are wrong on the right truck or the wrong truck. And there is an appeal process which is working its way, has begun anyways, and there's an attorney who is nice enough to do some pro bono work to start that and help out these truck owners.
I must say that since he volunteered to do this on Wednesday afternoon, the general tone on this forum instantly changed.
That's good.
And it was a tremendous outpouring of congratulations to Will for being such a guy to do this, number one. But number two, the more important thing is people stepped up and says, Will, if you need help, let me know.
That's good.
Anything you guys need, if I can help out, I will. And that's what should have happened on day number one. You know, let me help out however I can. You know, let's not worry about pointing fingers and bashing people and calling people names out of anger. Let's get these people their trucks. Let's find out what's going on. Let's fix the problem.
Right, right. Well, that's good. And it's good to see that that's happened in a relatively quick, you know, only took a couple of days, which was nice that someone stepped up. This didn't go on for weeks or months.
Yeah, it was a very long day and a half. But yeah, it's settled down and you know, of course, there's still a lot of questioning of the 25-year rule, a lot of anti-government chatter, but you're going to have that no matter what.
But and that 25-year rule is not going to change.
It's not.
It's not even worth it.
It's the thing is, the more you stir that up and you poke that bear, you're just as likely to see all exemptions disappear entirely as you are to see that 25-year exemption get relaxed. However, you know, I'll give my opinion on this. I think what should change and what realistically could change is a change in the process at Customs. I think we need to hold Customs to a higher standard. We need to have them be more consistent in terms of what they're doing on a port-by-port basis. And I think there needs to be a statute of limitations. Once it's been cleared, maybe they have a certain amount of time to figure out whether they screwed up or not or have appeals or whatever. But after a certain period of time, if it's been cleared by Customs, it should be okay.
It's not a bad thought. Something to look into, but and
again,
sure.
I think that's legally that's doable, I think it's a reasonable address to this problem.
Right.
You still have the 25-year rule. You still have the law as far as what comes into the country and not. But now it's just being handled more equitably and more fairly.
And I agree that, you know, some kind of statute of limitations would be a great addition. It would also be nice to see, not that, you know, customs agents aren't proficient in vehicles, most of them probably are, but in addition to being consistent, would be nice to see some kind of certification or something that they have to go through to, so they understand the vehicles that they're inspecting. You know, maybe have somebody who inspects Land Rovers, somebody who inspects, you know, certain marquees.
From what I understand, they are armed with much more Land Rover knowledge than they once had. They are all fairly proficient at it. At least they have access to lots of information now regarding that.
That is very good.
More so than other brands, which starts to seem a little unfair too. But then again, they say the Defender is their number one problem area.
And I think that brings up a little bit of background for why this is a problem. You know, we are keenly aware in the United States, and I think those outside the United States may not be as completely understanding why this has even come to this. And also goes to your point, Morgan, of why don't we have any specialists that in the Customs Border Protection that look at that, is because Defender's not available here, and we want them. There's that demand here for them. As you guys are well aware, you can get a North American spec that were only available here for, 2.5 years? There's the magical...
North American spec 110 was available 1 year only, and the 90 was available for 3 years after that.
So, and that's the magical 550 that we talked about?
525 110s, and I'm not sure the number on the 90s, but I think it was in the 3,000s? Low thousands.
Okay. So there's this...
And that was the 93...
93-110, and that was brought out in limited production to announce the coming of the 90, I believe, or something like that.
Yeah.
The 90 was available, a few thousand of them for, I believe it was 94 through 97, something like that.
I think 97 was the last year.
And
they
were actually being brought in under a short-term exemption from airbag standards, and the reason they stopped bringing them over was that exemption expired.
So that brings up that those vehicles you can still purchase here in the United States, but they are an exorbitantly high of value. They have retained their values, and in fact, they're worth more than they were at the time when they were original equipment here in the United States and they were brand new. You can see one that has 100,000 miles on, 150,000 miles, still go for $50,000. So they're holding this great value because we want them, and we would like these vehicles.
And we have a limited supply of them.
And we have an extremely limited supply of them. So no wonder this kind of activity, it almost lends itself to criminal activity, I suppose, potential alleged criminal activity taking place in order to supply that demand. And the Defender is unique, I think, in this, in the vehicle space, because they have continued for, what is it now, let's see, almost 25 years. And if you want to go back even further from the Series 3, then this is continuation, as we all know about and talk about. They're not, there's not a lot of difference in visually, anyways, from, a current Defender back to a Series 3. You can see the connection, and people, mistake it all the time. So, you have these vehicles, high demand here in the United States. You take a vehicle that looks relatively close to one that was built 25 years ago. Maybe someone could take a VIN, swap them, and then...
And that's part of the
problem. An unknowing custom agent would say, oh, that looks fine.
That's part of the problem. Due to their modular nature, it is very easy to move parts from one to another, and the new ones look very much like the old ones. And so it's very hard for the customs to tell.
Mm-hmm.
Any other brand of car, and it's pretty obvious to tell what's a 2000 versus what's a 1983.
Right. And you can tell a Corvette from, a current Corvette from a, 30-year-old Corvette. Yeah.
Right. And so that lends itself to problems, not only with sneaking something in that's newer than it should be, but also to trafficking in stolen vehicles and stolen parts, which is a huge problem in Europe, by the way. I'm not saying that's related to this particular incident we're dealing with, but it is a problem that they're stolen. I heard 15 a day are stolen in England alone, and many of them are cut up for the parts.
Well, and also in the UK, we've talked about this before, what the number one stolen vehicle in the UK is the Defenders.
Right, like I said, 15 a day.
Oh, I thought that was just all vehicles. I didn't realize that was
15 a day just in
Land
Rovers.
Wow. Land Rover Defenders or Land Rovers as a mark?
That I'm not certain of.
I mean, it's
15 a day of anything is still a lot in a little country like England.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and I think that includes certainly series Land Rovers as well, because theft on those is pretty high as well.
Right.
Because, just like it's easy to dupe a customs official, it's somewhat easy to dupe a purchaser as well. that you're buying a Defender. Not necessarily, but...
This is true, but actually from what I've seen also is that not all of these stolen vehicles are passed on as stolen vehicles. A lot of them are cut up for the parts. In fact, it's very common when your Landy gets nicked, as they say, that they find it a few days later, but it's minus its engine, its gearbox, its rear axle, its doors, its hood, et cetera, and the rest is left either upside down or smoldering or both.
Yeah, and I think we've mentioned in the past that there's a few companies you can buy part stamps from to make sure that you stamp all your parts. Not that that's going to help you actually recover any, but that's somewhat popular in the UK at least.
I've seen them also where the windows all have number plate, which is their equivalent of a license plate, the registration number etched into the glass on every window.
Wow. And we have to remember that, you know, Defenders and Series Land Rovers are used worldwide. There's a ton of them out there. So it's not just U.S. demand that's causing this.
And 70%
they can send the parts and vehicles
the
everywhere. Yeah.
Well, I think the demand particularly here is unique because they were not available for a number of years.
Yeah, we're one of the few countries where you can't get them.
Right. So I think that makes it a little more unique.
It creates the
market
largest,
value is
right,
so much higher.
It creates the largest profit potential for people.
Right. So we'll continue to follow the story as it changes and develops, and we'll have some links to, I think, the Defender Source it was.
DefenderSource.com is the forum in question. We can provide links also to some of these legal documents, which I've gotten access to. The important thing to keep in mind here is this is still ongoing, and there are things in the works, and there's an attorney on the job. I think we just kind of need to be patient and let them do their job and see what comes back truth-wise.
To the folks that had their trucks taken, seized is the official government word, we certainly feel for you. That's, you know, hopefully it wasn't your daily driver, and you have something else to get you around. Yeah, that certainly is an unpleasant thing to go through.
We're feeling your pain, brother. Hope you get your truck back very soon.
Yeah, as soon as possible.
And if you may not have heard that, dear listeners, but Harold's dog just agreed.
Our canine rover expert here is agreeing with us.
Exactly the right moment. I wish I had the mic on him. He should give him his own mic. He actually growled. It was nice. All right, we'll take a little break, and we'll come back and talk about something a little more fun, actual fun. Welcome back. You may have noticed there was no M word this month. It is taking a summer vacation. Harold will tell us why.
Brief hiatus, if you will, due to the outstanding events this month in terms of the issue we just discussed. I decided to devote my entire time this week to following that event. As such, there will be no M-word.
But next month we'll have
an M-word, just like we planned.
Great. So now we're going to talk about actual fun things. We're going to talk about some trail events, some rally events, and general adventuring. So first, we'll talk about the Pittsburgh Vintage Grand Prix. Well, you know, most of us here are located in Pittsburgh, and we attended the Vintage Grand Prix British Car Day, and that was actually yesterday, which was the 19th of July. And I drove my 109, Harold drove a 110, and there was we had a new gentleman show up that I had tracked down a month ago. he had recently imported his own 110, a military 110.
The people you bump into when you're driving around.
I was just driving around. I was headed home, and we told you that story. And his name is Ben, and tracked Ben down. And so Ben showed up with his camo netting, which looked killer on my truck. It looked good on his, but man, it looked killer on the 109.
Yeah, nice netting there, Ben. We're going to put it on my truck now.
I talked to him about it. I didn't just steal it. I asked him.
You asked him nicely before you stole it. Yes, you did.
I did. I didn't steal it. I borrowed it. He got it back.
He did get it back.
There were...
In usable condition, by the way, which is hard to do with netting.
That, I didn't realize
that stuff's
that catches on everything.
Oh, yes, absolutely. That stuff is a pain in the butt.
Oh, I put it on the front, and it caught on the tire. It caught on the gutter rails. There were two Range Rovers. I think there were three LR3s /4s, Disco 3, Disco 4s, no Disco 2s, my 109, 2 110s. Oh, I'm sorry. And Dave's 109.
Dave has a nice Series 2A 109. He comes out every year to collect his trophy. And his cohort, Disco Bill, was there with his D1.
I'm sorry. Bill. That's right. Disco Bill was there with his D1. So we had a really nice showing of Land Rovers, which for that in and of itself was good. But most especially yesterday, as we mentioned earlier, the weather was extremely overcast. It rained all night, and it rained into the morning on Saturday. So they held off allowing the vehicles to get on to the golf course, because it actually takes the show itself takes place on a golf course. And so they held off, and we got
primarily because every vehicle except our 10 or 12 that we had in the Rovers had trouble getting up the grassy hill onto the golf course.
In the wet grass. And so the turnout was probably, I'd say, a quarter to a third of what it normally is. There was the turnout by the cars that usually show up very low.
Right.
And there was, you know, the Mini was the mark of the year. There were a lot of Minis there, newer ones, older ones. One Aston Martin, and there were three or four Bentleys and a couple Rolls Royces.
And one lone TVR. There's usually not too many TVRs, but normally more than one.
There were two Lotus Elises. There were newer ones. There was a good showing, though, I think, of the MGs and of the Triumphs.
Yeah. Well, of course, it is hosted by the Western Pennsylvania Triumph Club, so there's always a good turnout of Triumphs. Surprisingly low turnout of Jags. There's usually quite a number of them, but only a few came out.
There were more, by the way. I don't think you got over to the international side. There were, and domestic side, there were a bunch over on the other side of the other hill.
Still much lower than the normal turnout, though. Absolutely.
The American side, where they have, you think you get a bazillion American cars, there was very, very little. It was even worse than the British side. There was a Studebaker, though. That Studebaker was outstanding.
It was a nice looking old Stud.
That was really nice.
I do like the comment during the awards presentation when they get to our class, and they say, "We know we can always count on you guys to show up no matter what the weather's doing."
Yep, we did. We showed up. When they finally released us to go onto the field from the road, they would send the standard road cars. They'd send them up one at a time, wait till we got to the top of the hill, which was probably about 200 feet or so. Then they'd send the next one until we get to the top of the hill. It was time for us to go. We just went. We all went in single file and just trucked right up.
Yeah, just trained right up. But, of course, they have to send the other ones one at a time in case they don't make it.
Right. And good news, there were four awards this year in the Land Rover class, Class 52, and we took all four slots. And when I say we, it's as in people we know and people in our local Land Rover club.
It was a 1-4, a complete podium sweep for the Fort Pitt Land Rover group.
Actually, it was, yes. 109 Dave took first. The new Ben with his military 110 took second. I took third in my 109. And the 110 that Harold drove took fourth place. So we'll have some pictures up. I got to get the pictures up, and then I'll have links too in the show notes.
Well, congratulations.
Well, thanks, sir. Appreciate it. You did some retweeting for us. That was pretty slick. I appreciate that.
No problem.
But it was perfect. Also, British weather day. You know, overcast and slightly raining. It made you feel like you were in the UK too.
Very damp.
Oh yeah, but nice time. And people came out and they looked at the trucks, and that was really nice. We like showing them off, and that was cool. I think we're the only mark that shows up. Drivers that actually sit with their vehicles the whole time. Seems like all the other Mark owners, they show up, they might talk, but then they go off and do other things. They're never really near their cars as much, I think, as we are.
With possible exception of the Rolls owners, who seem to stay near their vehicles just to keep an eye on them.
That 1923 Rolls that showed up.
Yeah, that was an awesome car.
It was that a silver spur or
that was a silver ghost?
Silver ghost, and the little sign on it said that it had. Actually spent time in Palestine and Jordan, and it had been brought back to the United States eventually, and they are not restoring it. They're just keeping it going, which is, I think, the perfect way to handle a car. This one had wood, in addition to the wood interior, it had this wood shelf in the back that made it look like a boat, the rear of a boat, and had like the teak, really just an outstanding car. And it had brass stampings on it.
Well, that period is referred to as the Brass Age. Cars of that period had lots of brass hardware.
And there's something there that I think you're going to need, Morgan. You need to have leaf spring covers. This one had this Rolls Royce had leaf spring covers. They were these looked like they were leather, and they strapped around the leaf springs to so you don't get stuff on yourself.
Fairly common among luxury cars of that era, by the way.
Would make sense just to cover that stuff up.
Keep it clean. Keep it neat. Keep it pretty.
So that was an event we had attended, and now upcoming events. So next weekend, at least based on current date, is the Billing Land Rover Fest taking place July 25th through the 27th in the UK. I know we talked about it a little more extensively last month, and so that's the Billing Land Rover Fest is taking place next weekend. If anybody is going or has attended and wants to talk about it, let us know. Either send us an email or maybe we'll get you on the podcast and you can talk about it.
And the same weekend is the Vermont Overland Rover event in southern Vermont, in Rockingham, Vermont. So I'm hoping that maybe I can make it to that event. Looking questionable at the moment, but I'll be doing my best.
We need a field correspondent at that event, so you need to make sure you go.
Well, just
I really want to go.
Show up as press. Put press on your hat, and say, oh, I'm with the press. Please see. Yeah,
technically, exactly. You are if you're covering it for us.
And staying in North America, the National Rally, Land Rover National Rally 2014, is taking place this year in Moab, Utah, September 16th through the 20th. Someday I will go to this event. It always looks like that part of the world. First of all, Moab is outstanding. That's a killer part of the world. If you've never been, I highly recommend everybody go there.
Moab is such a fantastic venue that, in fact, the National Rally is there every other year.
Right, they alternate.
I believe every even-numbered year it's in Moab, and then on the odd-numbered years it varies in different locations. Quite often it's Colorado in various locations, but it always comes back to Moab.
Yeah, it's a great great location, great trails, and it does look like Mars. It just the soil's red, dusty. It's also where very close to Monument National Valley, where they've filmed a lot of the westerns back in the 60s and 70s, just out in maybe 50s. Outstanding area. If you ever get a chance to go, and if anybody is going or has gone and wants to report on it for us, we're certainly open to that information. And of course, this is put on by the Sully Hall Society, and we'll have links to their page if you're looking to go. And back over in Europe, the biggest event taking place in Portugal is going to occur. They're going to get about 400 Land Rovers in September, and we'll have a link to that. Apparently, it's in Portuguese. I didn't do the Google Translate, at least on the whole site, so there will be a link there. And if we have any listeners in Portugal
or Brazil,
that's true. And if anybody's going and want to report on that for us, let us know how it is. That'd be very interesting. And there are other UK events that are taking place. We've talked about those before, and which is the Peterborough event. And what is the what was the one that's taking place the weekend after that Steve's going to go to the camping overland
expedition,
event
expedition something or other.
Yeah, and Steve couldn't join us, but hopefully next month he'll be back and he can tell us what's going on with those. So we talked about him last month, so I think we'll skip that for now. You can go back to last month's show if you want to know more about those. But also in the UK, this is kind of an interesting event. It's called the Bowden Big Weekender, taking place the 3rd through the 5th of October. And this is kind of an event that is going to go for, it's a 3-day journey going from Birmingham to Glengow in Scotland, Birmingham being in England. And I'll just read you right from their website here. Our aim is to raise enough donations to fund a 4x4 Land Rover rescue vehicle for the Glencoe Mountain Rescue Team. The rally has been organized in memory of Sean Bowden, if I'm not sure how to say that name correctly, who sadly lost his life last year whilst walking in the mountain range, and Glencoe Rescue Team were fundamental in Sean's search and recovery. And you can please help by joining the event or donating through this website. And we'll have a link to that website, which is actually bowdenbigweekender.co.uk. And so that's going to sound like it might be interesting. It sounds like more of an overland type event. But
I like the notion that it's a fundraiser to help fund search and rescue operations in this area. I also like the fact that it's very scenic, looking at the pictures on your screen there, and it certainly looks like it's rugged terrain enough where they could benefit from having a Land Rover-based truck to do their search and rescue with.
And there's one more event back in the U.S. that I had nearly forgotten about, put on by the same group who is putting on the Vermont Overland Rover event. August 4th through 9th is the Vermont Overland Trophy. They are basically trying to make a practicable and sustainable version of the Camel Trophy. So it's a challenge event, a team challenge event. So navigation and driving skills and camping efficiency and physical stamina, all of that. So looks pretty cool.
Is that the event we talked about last year, right? That Dave wanted to attend, right? That was the big trophy event.
I think Dave and Mike are both really drooling over the possibility of being in this, but it's actually hard to get slots for because it's a closed event and it's limited.
Right. Yep. Yeah. And this one is sponsored by Overland Journal, so.
Why aren't you attending? You're in Vermont. No, I know. We talked about this before. That's the one. There's a limited number of slots, and I think it's like it's $500, I believe, or something close to that. And that is that the one where you go from town to town looking for clues, and you had to buy like Vermont items that were it was like they're trying to be sustainable for Vermont and having you buy like you know honey and.
Yeah, I believe so.
And I think you had to have a receipt from lunch at a certain place to show that you checked in at that particular check station.
Right. And you had a truck with specific specifications. Sorry to be redundant. And you had two people, you know, a navigator and all that. So
Morgan, you really need to get that press credential going because you need to be there covering it for us. You don't even have to be an entrant; just be there as a press covering it. They ought to allow that.
Absolutely. I'll work on that.
You do that.
So finally, closing out our podcast today, back in North America, America's Best Car Touring Roads. Outside a magazine, outsideonline.com, listed what they consider, I guess, the best touring roads in the United States. Some of these I've not heard of, some I have, and certainly we'll have a link in the show notes. But just kind of go through them, maybe talk about them, and see if anybody maybe has been on them. So the Alaska Highway is about 1,400 miles. They say to go.
Is that including the Canadian portion, what they call the Alcan?
I believe so. Just a short bit that I'm reading here. I'm not going to go through every part of it, but they tell you to go in the summer, effectively.
I think you'd have to because it's not open parts of it during the winter. I have multiple friends that have driven it. They say it is fabulous. I have not seen it myself, but I have every reason to believe them.
Next is the number two, Oregon Coast Highway 101. This is about 350 miles. Say it's three driving days, and you should go in September for small crowds. So I have not been to Oregon myself, but
the entire West Coast coastline, anywhere you're not in a city on the water, is fabulous. It's all rugged coastline. Oregon is particularly good. Certain parts of California, number one, are excellent as well for the same reasons.
Does that connect? Does this Oregon 101 connect with the Pacific Coast Highway?
Trying to remember. I think it might.
And the Pacific Coast Highway and US 1 are the same road, right?
It's California 1.
California 1, okay.
US 1 is on our end of the country.
Oh, okay. And then number 3 on the list here is the Blue Ridge Parkway in Virginia, North Carolina. I've been on parts of that. That's about 469 miles, and that's...
Yeah, it's very nice, especially in the fall with the trees turning.
Outstanding. And just to be... You're going to go... I think the speed limit is like 35 miles an hour. Which, just to be aware of.
So, in other words, don't worry about it if you're in a series truck.
Exactly. But if you
get used to hill climbs.
And hill climbs, but if you think you're taking that to quickly get from Front Royal to somewhere, it's not
a shortcut.
It's not a shortcut by any stretch, not at all. Back to Alaska, the Seward and Sterling Highways, 294 miles. Go in the summer, of course.
Pretty much anywhere in Alaska you want to go in the summer.
I would think so. Route 66 in Arizona, 401 miles. They say go in May. Looks like there's some detours. You can go to the Petrified Forest. I've not been on Route 66. Anybody else get their kicks?
Well, I have, of course, done the interstate derivative thereof more times than I could count. But the neat thing is that the original 66 route parallels that, and you can get off and sort of do a stretch of 66 pretty easily. Now, I would love to do the entire 66 in its length, or at least all that remains of it, in one shot, but I don't have the time for that. But I try when I'm on these trips to sort of take a little diversion for a little bit and drive part of the original roadway, and it's not, of course, probably as nice as it was in its glory days. A lot of the little mom-and-pop places have closed, but it's still a lot of fun. And if you can get even a little bit of it in, it's worth doing.
I think I saw something on the news recently where there's a couple places have reopened on 66 because it's becoming a kind of a tourist destination. Mm-hmm. People are taking it just to take the road. And
I'd heard that they're working on restoring some of the original route.
Looks like the original road is 2,451 miles from Chicago to Santa Monica. Then we have number six, the Enchanted Circle Scenic Byway in New Mexico. Never been.
Well, New Mexico is fabulous pretty much anywhere you go, so I'm not really surprised that this would be good, too. I've not heard of it. I don't know it, but I do enjoy New Mexico.
And number seven is, guess where? Back again to Vermont, Scenic Route 100.
Morgan's driveway.
Coming in.
Pretty much. It drives right by my office.
Do you have to do you take that road?
It's a beautiful drive. Oh, yeah. It's a beautiful drive down through nice, tight little valleys along rivers and then up and over through the mountains. It's gorgeous. We actually had a few years ago Hurricane Irene wiped out most of the state. Because everything just dumped down through these tiny little rivers and streams and washed everything out. So actually a fair amount of Route 100 has been rebuilt over the last couple of years. So it's the roads are a little smoother now. Some of the bends are not quite as tight as they used to be. You can sort of, you know, take in all of the normal sights and then also get to see some of the aftermath of that hurricane.
Now, is that your daily commute?
Mine is perpendicular, but yeah, part of it, about 5 miles, is on Route 100.
Next up is number eight, San Juan Skyway in Colorado. I've been to Colorado. I would agree. It's almost like any almost western state. Anywhere out there is just outstanding to drive through in Colorado. I can imagine. I don't think I've been on the San Juan Skyway, but
I've done parts of it. It's nice.
And then staying out west, going to Sun Road Glacier National Park in Montana. Montana is another big sky, it's big sky country, another great state to drive through. And I believe, no, they used to have the no speed limit, but I think they're back to having a 70-mile-an-hour speed limit.
Well, of course, everyone went 55 back in the 70s. Prior to that, there were a number of places with no speed limit. But since then, it's a matter of, yeah, everybody's been relaxing, but I don't think anyone's ever gone to no limit.
No, they did.
Did they?
Yeah, for about 5 years, they had...
Post-double nickel, they went no limit?
Yes.
Wow.
For a couple of years, and then there was no limit. But I think at nighttime, it dropped to like 60 or something. But I think they put it back in.
I did not know that.
And little nice, since we're talking about speed limits, Pennsylvania has gone to 70. A year ago, the law went into effect, and finally, there's going to be one road out near Harrisburg.
Welcome to the 21st century.
And finally, on the best touring car roads, at least according to Outside Magazine, is the Outer Banks National Scenic Byway in North Carolina. Having been down there, I can understand. That's a nice part of the country.
Well, that's one of Dave's popular summer spots is down there.
Mm-hmm. Well, that whole Outer Banks area.
He goes pretty much every year down there.
Yeah.
Takes his disco, does some fun stuff.
Garcia's been down there a couple times, too, and driven around. I think there's parts there where you can actually drive onto the beach, and you know, you need four-wheel drive only.
Absolutely. So that was the point of getting his disco running that last time in time for his trip.
That's absolutely correct, yes. Something that's not on the list that I would add, of course, is where the national rally is taking place. I just find eastern Utah around the Moab area to be just outstanding. That would be another place to go.
Actually, the road itself is rather boring, but the scenery alongside the road is quite lovely.
It is. I when I was out there, the one time I was there, the cop pulled me over late at night to tell me that there was deer. So that was the only reason he was pulling me over, just to let me know.
Well, that was polite of him.
It was, actually. It was really nice. Yeah, it was, you know, he says, hey, watch out for some deer, you know.
Yeah. On the subject of speed limits, one of the things, since we were talking about that, one of the things I really enjoyed about some of these western roads was their interesting take on the enforcement of the 55 back in those days and the fact that technically the speed limit was 55, but their enforcement practice was as long as you were under 70, all they really cared about was that you were wasting fuel. I encountered many nominal tickets for wasting of fuel back in those days.
There you go. It's all back to money. And on that, dear listeners, we have come to the conclusion of another episode of the Center Steer Podcast. This has been episode number 16. If you have any comments, please do not hesitate to email, tweet, or give me a call. But I'm not going to give you my phone number. You'll have to find that on your own. And let us know what you
Careful.
Think.
Careful. Throwing down that gauntlet.
Go ahead. Go ahead and call. Go right ahead.
It's a challenge now.
It's just become personal.
So I'll be on vacation for 2 weeks, and we will be back in late August to talk more Land Rover news and information.
The Center Steer theme song, Sunset Rider by the Tritons, is available from Nivio's Music Alley. Check it out at music.nivio.com.
Morgan, talk. I want to see if you show up on
Skype. Yeah. That would be nice after all our work to get that figured out.
That looks like Morgan there.
His blobs seem a tad fatter than ours. That's been my thing here. So.
Yes, he's called Fat Blobs.